Good day. Welcome to the Corey Morgan Show. Thanks for joining me on yet another, at least out here in Alberta, cold winter day. March is coming in like a bloody lion. Let's hope it goes out like a lamb. I can't stand winter. I really can't. I've been in Canada all my life, and still I've just never learned to enjoy winter. Aside from the lack of mosquitoes, I really don't see a lot of good out of it. Either way, hopefully things thaw out pretty soon. That'll kind of tie into some talk, you know, about heating, energy, electricity, things like that. So a little later, I'm going to have guests on Jay Yu and James Walker of Nano Nuclear Energy. These guys are a company that creates micro nuclear reactors and really portable. We're talking about something that can be moved on a tractor trailer in sea cans. So perhaps, you know, that's something in the energy mix that might be a bit of a game changer around the world as we all seem to try to scramble to keep our energy sources secure. As well, a little later on, I'm going to have Franco Terrazano check in. We haven't had Franco on for a while. He's with the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. He's got a few updates on what we can look forward to on April 1st. That's the federal government's favorite time of the year to really make us bend over, lube up, and take our tax increases for the season. So we'll have Franco on to talk a little later. I see Jordan and Mr. Stanley checking in on the comment scroll. Yes, if you're watching live, guys, be sure to check in, send me your questions, comments, chat with each other. Just keep it civil, that's all. You know, we don't have to be at each other's throats. We lost time for that. But I've only got 45 minutes with you today. All right, I'm going to get on with what's got me going, though. I mean, I don't have to be too happy about everything I talk about. Let's talk some federal politics. I'm going to quote our leader, Justin Trudeau. In 2021, Prime Minister Trudeau infamously said, "You'll forgive me if I don't think about monetary policy." Unfortunately, Trudeau in that case was actually being absolutely honest. He doesn't think about monetary policies, and the cost for his willful ignorance is going to be borne for generations. And no, we shouldn't bloody well forgive him. We should be trying to find a way to get that incompetent, unprincipled boob out of office as soon as possible. The economic canary in the coal mine in Canada has been dead for years. The warnings were clear. Canada was on a path to economic catastrophe, but the Trudeau government ignored the signs and charged ahead with their agenda of mass spending coupled with mass immigration. I mean, this is a government on the ropes. Their popularity levels are rivaling the end of the Mulroney government when they ended up getting wiped out down to two seats under Kim Campbell. And instead of reevaluating what they're doing, they're doubling down with what they've already been doing, and it's making it worse. So, I mean, as the government continued with its policy of borrowing money and pouring it into the economy, guess what? Inflation followed. That's economics 101. But remember, Trudeau doesn't think about monetary policy. So action, reaction to try and counter the inflation problems. The Bank of Canada has been cranking up interest rates. And yeah, that does slow inflation, but that's because it slows the entire economy. As businesses defer capital investment and housing starts slow down. I mean, to counter the economic slowdown and the risk of recession that comes with that, the government then has opened the floodgates to mass immigration. Sure, new immigrants bring skills and resources that do, in the short term, spur the economy, but they also consume resources. The influx of new Canadians has led to a housing crisis. And of course, with the interest rates rising and housing prices going through the roof, mortgage delinquency rates are soaring. In Ontario alone, they've shot up 135%. These are people about to lose the homes they put their lifetime of savings and investment into. Younger people, they can't even consider buying a home with current prices. They're forced to rent. And that's not a solution. Rents have been rising as fast as the home prices. People are being forced to bunk up or move back in with their parents. Between the skyrocketing cost of living and the addiction epidemic, homelessness is chronic now and it's growing. In every province in the country as well, the healthcare systems are overwhelmed. Waiting times for hospitals and procedures are reaching new highs with every month. Schools, no different. They're under pressure as immigrants pour into the system faster than the system can expand to accommodate them. And let's look at the business world. In January of this year, just a couple months ago, business insolvencies in Canada went up 129% over the January period of 2023. The taxes, regulations, interest rates, and anti-business climate in Canada is crushing our enterprises. Canada is becoming an investment pariah. While the Prime Minister might have no idea what he's going to do, and what he is doing to the economy, business leaders do. They won't put funding into the economic basket case of Canada. It's a global market, and we're being left behind. It's not just bad monetary policies that are keeping investment out of Canada. It's the environment and attacks on businesses themselves. I mean, grocers and oil companies executives, they've been dragged before parliamentary committees where they've been questioned on their business decisions. It's kind of Soviet-like in feel, but that's not surprising considering Trudeau partnered with a socialist to try and remain in power. How could any business leader want to come to Canada and set up shop in that sort of environment? Having the government constantly attacking and shutting down proposed resource development certainly isn't helping either. It doesn't matter if the nation sits on massive natural resource reserves if the government won't allow it to be developed. The most frightening indicator, though, of just how far up the economic creek Canada has gone is the GDP per capita ratio. To put it in lay terms, add up all of the economic output in Canada and divide it by the population. That's the ratio, and that ratio has dropped steadily for the last six quarters. You know, the banks are calling out, economists are calling out, the only ones who seem unconcerned about it are the morons in government under Justin Trudeau. Let's look at the comparison. The GDP per capita in the USA is about $70,000 American dollars. In Canada, it's $52,000 American dollars and falling. The entire nation is becoming poorer, and quickly. Trudeau's been on a mass hiring binge of civil servants, but that only helps the unemployment figures. Civil servants don't contribute to the economy, they drain from it. I mean, Canada's faced depressions and recessions before. Hard times have come and gone, but what's happening right now is different. Canada's economy is being dismantled and destroyed by the most incompetent and ideologically driven government we have ever seen. The only question we have now is how long are we going to let this go before somehow finding a way to pressure that administration out of power? I mean, in other countries, people will be out in the streets by now, but in Canada, we seem to be still stuck on watching reality TV. Trudeau might not like to think about economic policies, but I guess he's not alone. Canadian citizens don't like watching it either, but it's going to catch up with you. So guys, all I can say is it's going bad. It's going bad fast. Start paying attention. Let's get that boob out of office sooner rather than later, because it's going to take generations to clean up the mess he is creating. And some of it's our own fault. We got to change it. All right, that's what's got me ranting and raving to start the day off. Let's see what else will get me pissed off today and check in with our news editor, Dave Naylor, see what else is going on in the big bad world. Hey, Dave, how's it going?
Good. Well, I hope I'm not responsible for pissing you off, Corey.
No, just the news copy you put out there, that's all.
Yeah, that's good. Like you, though, I am getting fed up of February weather in March. So apparently there's hope coming for the weekend, so not above zero for the weekend. But got to tell you a fun story from earlier this week. I was having a beer at my local pub, the Wink and Owl, best wings in the city, by the way, Corey. And I was chatting with a woman, and I'd introduced myself as Dave earlier on, and she says, "What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm a journalist." "Well, who are you with?" "Well, I work for the Western Star." "You're Dave Naylor. I listen to you every morning when I'm doing my makeup on the podcasts." So, yeah, well, at least one person listens to us, Corey, and either this or the pipeline in podcasts, and doing it every morning while she puts on her makeup. So I was very chuffed.
Well, good. A shout out to her then. I hope the makeup is going well.
Exactly. So hopefully she'll be listening tomorrow. But, yeah, speaking of weird stuff, we've got got a few weird ones going on at the moment, Corey. Got a story on a guy in Germany. I'm assuming there's got to be some mental illness going on with this guy, but in the space of 2 years, he had 217 COVID vaccination shots. You know, he was going around all over the country being injected every 3 or 4 days with a COVID shot. 217. Now, the good news is he didn't get COVID, but I guess they're kind of studying him to see whether he's going to start growing, arms out of his forehead or something like that. Our Lee Harding's got a story out of Saskatchewan in which the opposition is up in arms because a cabinet minister was spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars a day being chauffeured around Paris as he attended a conference. Got a story on David Parker. You remember the leader of Take Back Alberta went on a bit of a unhinged rant a couple weeks ago attacking Pierre Poilievre's wife. He says he's taken time to reflect, and he says he was wrong and promises never to personally insult anybody yet in the future. Speaking of weirdos, Doritos. You know, I don't know why these companies aren't learning the mistake of Bud Light. Bud Light lost billions in stock value with Dylan Mulvaney, and now Doritos has done it. They've partnered with a transgender man, woman, for 2 days before they discovered disgusting text messages he had put out on things he wanted to do to young girls in the middle of the street. So his time as a Dorito spokesman ended fairly quickly. Our Dave Makichuk, a military expert, has got a column on Canada's attempts to send rockets to Israel. Sorry, not Israel, the Ukraine. Getting my wars mixed up there. A Rivecan accountant said in testimony to the Commons, "Yeah, we knew something was going on here in this $60 billion boondoggle. We knew something was going on, but you know, we were too afraid of committing a career suicide by reporting it. And the Bank of Canada today held their interest rate at 5%. So any hopes for those people getting a bit lower or a bit of a break in mortgages if it had drops were dashed today, but they'll be looking at it again in April. So that's what's got our attention right now, Corey.
Right on. Yeah, lots on the go. It is pretty sad that it's hard to keep track of which wars we're funding at which given time. We're in a rough period of history right now.
Certainly are.
All right. Well, thanks for the update. I'll let you get wrapped up with your news so you can rush down to the Winkin' Owl for your next round of fan adulation down there.
There you go. Got to do the pipeline with you first, though.
So. Oh, yeah. We still got that other show. All right. Thanks, Dave.
Take care, Corey.
That is our news editor, Dave Naylor. And yeah, you can see the stories again. They're always coming hard and heavy. Lots of stuff going on out there. And this is when I like to remind everybody the reason we have those stories, the reason we have the staff and we're as busy as we are is because you guys have been subscribing. So thank you very much to subscribers. You get $10 a month, $100 for a year, good bulk deal. And you get past that pesky paywall and it keeps us independent. We aren't tax funded. We don't want tax funding. We stay independent. That makes us answerable to you, not to the government or any of the other areas like other media outlets have been lately. So if you haven't subscribed yet, get on there, westernstandard.news/subscription. Nag your friends to get on there, subscribe. It's really important to keep our news independent as things change. And if you've already subscribed, again, thank you very much. I appreciate it. You know that go woke, go broke story. Hey, it just keeps going on. So now we got Doritos into it or whatever it was. I mean, come on, guys. You're into Mexican food. Tacos. If you sell tacos, don't switch to sausages. Your customer base won't appreciate it. Sports Illustrated figured that one out as well, the hard way. Just lay off. Just stick to your products. How many businesses really, by embracing these woke ideals and things, have seen an increase in sales? How many have actually had a good outcome from it? Just get out of it, guys. Stick to plain vanilla celebrity endorsements. I mean, you got to get these DEI nutcases out of your marketing departments and get back to reality. It's not doing your sales any favors. I don't care about it. I just want a taco chip or a nacho chip. Or, you know, back when I used to drink, yeah, I didn't really care about the virtue signaling of the beer company. I was just looking at price and flavor. Whatever. They keep going down that road. You know, interesting. So, yeah, that was brought up with the cabinet minister. I don't talk about Saskatchewan enough. And I'm getting a little worried about the Saskatchewan party. They've been in power for 17 years, you know, and when parties are in for too long, whether they're conservative or liberal or NDP, if they're in too long, things go bad. We're certainly seeing it on the federal front. And on the provincial front, we're starting to see those cracks showing in the Saskatchewan party. And it worries me because they've kind of got a two-party system on the go. I know they got some other parties trying to get going. I think the Sask Unity Party or something like that. But it's getting reminiscent, I guess, of the Redford years with the Progressive Conservatives in Alberta. I mean, they'd been in for 40 years, and the waste and the arrogance was getting out of control with them. You know, they'd lost track of why they were there. So when you see a minister going, and you see it's the minor things. I know it doesn't break the budget, but this is what sticks in the mind of the public, because they got a close election coming this fall, and when you got a cabinet minister going to Paris and touring around, and then it turns out that he spent thousands on a private chauffeur service, $3,500 to go tour things around Paris that had nothing to do even about what he was supposed to be there for. He was supposed to be for a nuclear exhibition, and instead he was touring other things. Like, I don't mind multitasking with these politicians. Okay, you go over there. If you've done your business part over on whatever you had to, met the people you had to, and you want to run around and do some touring, fine, take an Uber. Take a taxi. Come on. We're not talking about the prime minister here. We're not talking about even a premier. Look, nobody knows who Dustin Duncan is outside of Saskatchewan. He didn't need extra security. You can jump in an Uber or a taxi, go see those things and come back. But instead, no, he thought he would expense $3,500 to the taxpayers and go touring. Dude, this is the sort of crap that gets you thrown out of office. This is the sort of thing that sticks in the voters' minds. I know the voters should be thinking about the billions rather than the thousands, but it's the thousands that resonate with other people. People who can't afford their bills, their rent, their mortgage payments, and then they see this sort of arrogance being used with their money. That's what gets you in trouble. another area that's showing that the Saskatchewan party's been in a bit too long was a recent release too. It sounds like municipalities, their donation system, most provinces have closed up this loophole. Alberta used to have it, but municipalities can actually donate to political parties, which is not good because the municipalities, of course, I mean, it's an instant conflict of interest. The provincial government transfers funds to the municipalities, of course, for infrastructure projects and things such as that. The municipalities shouldn't be able to donate to the political parties then, because, of course, they're looking to buy favor. And again, even if it's not been abused, this voter sees it as abuse. And it sounds like tens of thousands of dollars have gone from municipalities towards Saskatchewan party fundraisers. These are the cracks that are showing, guys, and you've got to be careful, because this fall, if this sort of thing keeps up, this kind of arrogance, you don't understand why the voters are getting turned off you. They're going to be replaced this fall, and they're going to be replaced by the NDP. And again, you get to a cure that's worse than the disease. Alberta learned that lesson the hard way already once. I'd hate to see Saskatchewan have to learn to do so as well. All right, let's get on to the subject of our guests here. I've been looking forward to this. Again, energy. Energy has been a huge, huge news story and issue. It's going on. We're, as in Alberta, supposed to be an energy capital of Canada, yet we have shortages, we have instability, and we don't hear about nuclear enough and the developments within it and where it's coming along. And these guys with nano-nuclear energy sound really exciting, actually, with some of the stuff they've been developing with micro-nuclear technology. And I've got James Walker and hopefully JU coming on soon to discuss and expand a bit on that. So we got James for now, and let's see what they got going. Hey, James, how's it going?
Hi there, Corey. I'm not too bad.
Good. Well, I appreciate you coming on to join us today. As I kind of said in the intro, you know, we're in an energy-producing province. We've talked about nuclear for decades, but it just never seems to actually get off the ground around here. Part of it is it's such a long game, too. When you're playing with the applications and development and building something of that scale, it just never quite makes it. But you guys are a little different. I mean, this is very portable, very quick, and can be applied a lot of different ways. Can you kind of expand on what your company does?
Yeah, of course. So you're absolutely right about those long lead times for those big civil power plants. And traditionally, that's because these are very large installations where all the fuel that's going to power this thing for the next few decades is all up front. But the reason why there's big emphasis on SMRs, microreactors, is because if you shrink down the reactor and it uses less fuel and it's less complex, then the time to actually launch these things is theoretically a lot faster. The capital cost comes down, the financing cost related to the capital cost comes down. And that's where the US and Canada are beginning to look towards being the future of the nuclear industry. So Alberta is actually a great state for industry. And already there's quite a lot of industries there that are looking at powering chemical operations, oil and gas operations, remote locations, remote industrial projects. Nuclear is the only solution really for those things, because wind and solar can't be put anywhere you want. They are only intermittent energy sources, and they need big storage facilities. They need big land areas. And really, if you're looking to try and nuclearize and power these remote industrial projects, nuclear is the only alternative to sort of diesel generators and fossil fuels.
So, I mean, the number one question I'm certain you get, I mean, people have had a very negative interpretation or impression of nuclear. I mean, since the China syndrome, you know, way back when I was just a child, it was coming out on there. But the safety, I mean, and it's important. People should be, you know, at least asking about that. These are presumably very safe reactors then.
Yes, you know, we have to contend, of course, quite often with the safety questions being asked, but it's very easy for us because all we can do is just dispense the facts about nuclear. And we can say to people, look, if you look at, just take the big civil power plants, even if you look at deaths per gigawatt hour generated, nuclear beats out wind, solar, everything, and orders of magnitude safer than all the fossil technologies anyway. So nuclear is already the safest form of energy. When you shrink the reactor down to an SMR and then a microreactor, it gets safer still. So we have the safest form of energy getting even safer. And I think nuclear has always suffered from misconceptions and bad PR. And obviously we're trying to change that. And obviously we're doing things like talking to you to try and explain to people that, you know, the safety concerns you have might be a bit of a misapprehension about the technology itself and the dangers at play. But we just need to get that message out there. And public sentiment is improving. We are seeing gradually more acceptance of nuclear power. And I think once we can couple that knowledge about how safe it is with decreased energy costs for the consumer, then you know the public support should really balloon.
So these generation sources are very portable and can be moved quickly. I saw one of the applications proposed. Isn't it actually in the case of an emergency, if there's a natural disaster or something has happened that the regular power grid has been knocked down, these sorts of reactors could be brought into place to bring supplemental power during that emergency period. It's a very interesting application for it then.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it doesn't stop there. I mean, the potential market here is a $1 trillion industry. Like it's mining sites, oil and gas sites, remote habitation, maritime vessels, like aircraft carriers and submarines currently use nuclear, charging stations for EV vehicles, data centers, AI centers, Bitcoin mining, if you really want to go that route. So even in remote countries with remote communities that are cut off from the larger grid, desalination plants, medical facilities, all of that can be powered with microreactors. It could be a very transformative technology just for the world.
Yeah, well, and in isolated areas like Alberta, where we have the oil sands developments up north, they're energy intensive to get the oil out. We burn a lot of natural gas to get, SAGD and things like that going on. I would imagine if you moved in a nuclear, a modular nuclear facility in, you don't have to build that electrical transport infrastructure as well. Like you could run it for the project and then deactivate when the project is finished.
I mean, that's the big incentive here is that, a lot of these projects do run on fossil fuels, and that means that there's almost a daily importation of diesel or fuel that you need to do this. But with a microreactor, all your fuel is there in one place for the next 15 years of operation. So all of your logistical concerns can be dispensed with. And when you are finished with it, the thing can just be decommissioned and moved out of there. I mean, this is where we're trying to get to, almost like a nuclear battery on a truck that could insert. And once it's inserted, you run it just for how long you need. And we don't even necessarily need to sell you the reactor. We could just sell you the energy that you need over the period you want it for.
So going further into that, what about the waste issue then? I mean, when the fuel has been spent, it still leaves a product that has to be safely handled and disposed of. I imagine you've got plans for that.
We do. And I think the waste issue is almost similar to the safety issue in a way, that I think the scale of it is not really appreciated. So if I just say, if you were to take all of the reactors that have ever operated in North America, including the States, all the way back to the 50s, and that includes all the aircraft carriers, submarines, all the big civil power plants, and you were to collect all of that waste in one location, it wouldn't fill a football field. It produces an amazingly small amount of waste, and that's because the energy density of uranium is just so huge. So a microreactor, if you can imagine it, it operates for 15 years and you're producing less than a golf ball of highly irradiated waste. It's not really going to be much of a waste issue. Remarkably, actually, with our reactors, because the power output is so much lower than a big civil power plant, the burn up of the fuel is less than 1% after about 15 years of operation. So it's almost new fuel after over a decade of use. And so obviously we don't want to throw that away. We want to take that back and refurbish it and then put it back in the reactor and ship it out again, because it's essentially new. That's how energy dense this stuff is.
Okay, I've got a comment here with a question, Peter LaFontaine saying, are these small modular reactors available now, and what sort of price point are we talking about? I mean, are they within reason?
So they're not available now, and we still need to go through the licensing process, and that's the big lead time operation, because the regulatory process for getting a nuclear energy system license is a lot longer than for anything else, and it's mostly to do with how technical the facilities are attached to this. But we've got to go through that process. We'll begin seeing microreactors before the end of this decade. We'll see SMRs before the end of this decade as well, a bit bigger than a microreactor, and those could power chemical plants, oil and gas, oil sands, all those kind of projects as well. But yeah, so they're coming, and all the infrastructure is being built up accordingly. And it's not just Canada that's looking at this too, but the United States and the Department of Energy there is throwing a huge amount of money at big infrastructure projects to build back their capability to mass manufacture fuel, deconverted fuel, and build these things.
We've got a lot of companies operating in Canada, and I can certainly see why they'd be interested in it. Have any started the process and working towards this? Again, we always hear talk of it, but we just haven't quite seen it come to fruition yet.
Yeah, so Canada's nuclear industry is actually really good. They went the CANDU reactor route, but that gave them a lot of expertise in that particular region, and they obviously had to build up a lot of expert personnel and infrastructure to support all that. So they're well placed to actually slide into the new generation of SMRs, and there are a number of SMR companies being built up in Canada, and even Canada Westinghouse, they're looking at building an SMR and deploying to power a lot of infrastructure within Canada. So it's happening. We don't know whether the first reactors to commercially launch will be from the States or Canada. But either way, I think Canada will eventually produce its own SMR and microreactors that can deploy around the country. It's, you know, obviously Alberta is going to be a big focus of it because it's very industry focused, and these big industries have a lot of mandates to bring in alternative forms of power other than fossil fuels. But even in the north of Alberta, so Northwest Territories, Yukon, we've got a lot of remote communities up there. It's enormously expensive to power those places. And to deploy a microreactor up there where you've got, say, a community of only 800 on a yearly basis, that could be over $10 million in just diesel costs alone, just to fuel. Those costs would essentially half go to a tenth of what they would be, because you have a microreactor to power it for 15 years, essentially.
So with this kind of reactor to generate power, like one of the issues we have with renewables, Alberta and a lot of areas have put in a lot of windmills and a lot of solar projects and things like that. But the problem is, if the wind doesn't blow, the sun doesn't shine, you've got to go to your backup sources. We could turn off and on our natural gas-fired power, though we've had challenges now. It's getting to the point where we're kind of maxing it up. But we can do it quickly if we need to. With nuclear ability, is it able to really bring it on stream quickly and bring it off for on-demand sort of use?
Yeah, so the way the terminology they use in the energy industry is capacity factor, and that's essentially almost a percentage of how consistent the power is. So if you look at solar, it would be about like a 15% energy capacity, and wind would be about a 25% capacity factor. Nuclear is the highest. It actually is a higher capacity factor than gas or coal or any other form of energy, the highest capacity factor. That means that it is the most readily accessible amounts of energy for when you need it. And you can ramp up and ramp that down very easily. It's just a matter of control rod insertion and extraction. So not only is it the cleanest and safest form of energy, it's going to be the most consistent form of energy. And it won't suffer from, unfortunately, what wind and solar need to do is install big storage facilities that are very expensive and occupy big amounts of landmass to install, and then still not be able to be consistent in their power output.
Yeah, and finally, I guess, as we kind of wrap up, that's been a big issue in Alberta. We've had some battles, was the amount of footprint that a solar or a wind generation facility takes up. I mean, with agricultural land or even just is not necessarily aesthetically all that good. These modular plants are very, very small.
They're very, very small, and they occupy a very small footprint. And look, we realized when we launched the company and we were trying to identify how to design our reactors, what the markets would be, we saw that actually, you know, the carbon, people complain about carbon footprints, but the carbon footprint of actually occupying a huge amounts of land with wind and solar farms actually was quite significant. And so you can actually end up being quite a polluting source of carbon emissions by installing these big facilities there that then aren't consistent, that then need storage on top of that too. And the costs can run away with you. Not just the land use can run away with you, but you end up needing to use, say, three or four times the land that you would think you would need for wind and solar, because it's got to make up for that inconsistency and the intermittent power. And so you've got to produce more and store it to make up for that, the fact that the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine.
Yeah, well, with the portability, the lack of emissions, and the lack of intermittent issues, I mean, they all sound to solve a lot of the challenges we've got going with energy generation right now. I appreciate you coming in to talk to us today. And as you pointed out, I mean, a lot of what we've got in our heads, I mean, they're legitimate concerns on safety, but statistically, actually, yeah, they've always been quite safe. Where can people find more information about your company and what's been going on with it?
So I would go to nanonuclearenergy.com. You can sign up to our mailing list. We are on Twitter and we do have Facebook, and you can follow us there too. But please reach out to us anytime. And look, anybody who does reach out to us, we will get an answer back to you quickly.
Great. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. I look forward to seeing these new forms developing and moving in up here. I really do feel that we need to start seeing some of that type of energy getting going up here instead of us keep spinning our wheels and some of the less than reliable ones out there.
Agreed. All right. Thank you very much for having us on, Corey.
All right. Thanks again. So, yes, check them out, guys. Nano Nuclear Energy. We really got to start thinking outside the box. And this is, nuclear is not new, but getting it down to this micro level, this portability. And as he said, and I noticed one of the commenters brought up Fukushima. Sure. But again, when we look at a world with billions of people, when we look at thousands and thousands and thousands of means of generation, whether it's coal, whether it's gas, whether it's nuclear, whether it's wind, statistically, the ones that cause the least amount of harm are still actually nuclear. We saw Chernobyl. But I mean, you got to think about that. That was during the Soviet era. I mean, the Soviet Union couldn't even make a good alarm clock back in those days. I'm surprised they only had one reactor meltdown. The world is lucky for that. We've gotten much better since then. And that was the worst. I mean, when you think of thousands of reactors around the world. So we should open some of these discussions. I love Alberta being an energy powerhouse. And, instead of jealously guarding ourselves from other forms of energy coming in, we should be looking at other ones we can embrace. And small modular nuclear generation could be most definitely another one of those ways. But of course, and I'll segue that in, we got to watch for a government that taxes these businesses into oblivion or makes things unviable up here, no matter how optimistic we might be on that. And we've got a government that really is just determined to crush our economy, as I sort of ranted about to kick off the show. So we're going to talk to somebody who specializes in all those taxes and goodness, because we've got our annual April 1st kick in the pants coming from the federal government. And Franco Terrazano of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation is going to tell us all about it. Hey, Franco, how's it going?
Hey, Corey. Great to be talking to you, man. Hope you're doing well.
Yeah, good, good. Yeah, it's been a while since you've been on.
It has. Yeah, too long, man. Too long since I've been back in Calgary as well.
Yeah. So the April 1st, I know everybody jokes about it being April Fool's Day, but it is also the day that the federal government really likes to kind of lay on the bulk of their increases. They kind of hit us. I mean, my theory has always been people are in a good mood. Winter's melting off, summer's approaching, they're planning their vacations, they got their tax return perhaps, and they might not be thinking about it as much. So the government times that real swift kick at that period of the year. What do we got going on this April?
Well, April 1, carbon tax up, alcohol taxes up, and MP pay, member of parliament pay, you guessed it, folks, also going up. Isn't that nice? Hey, on the very same day that they take more money out of your wallet, they're going to be stuffing more money into their own. Now, happy to break it all down, but let's just start with the member of parliament pay raise. So right now you have a backbencher who's collecting dust in the House of Commons is also collecting $194,000 salary. You have Trudeau that's collecting a salary about $389,000. Well, the April 1 pay raise will range from an estimated extra $8,000 for a backbencher to an extra $16,000 for Trudeau. So let me just tell you what that salary will be after the raise. Backbenchers, $202,000. Ministers like Freeland or Guilbeault, $299,000. Now, I don't know why Freeland would get a raise when she can't balance the budget of a lemonade stand, but that's another conversation. And the prime minister's salary after the raise, $405,000.
Do you guys do any comparisons with, say, other comparable countries to ours? Like, is Canada on the high side of compensation when it comes to our elected officials?
Yeah, I do remember even seeing the Hill Times doing a comparison about this just after last year's raise. And Canada was, if I can remember correctly, one of the high ones among the G7. I know for a long time, we've also been quite high among Commonwealth countries. But what also is What also is unique, if I could use that word, about our federal government is that while many other countries around the world saw politicians cut their pay during the lockdowns, the pandemic years, like remember Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, blast from the past, sorry folks, but she took a 20% pay cut when the pandemic happened, her ministers and her top bureaucrats. But every single year since the beginning of 2020, since these tough times, MPs of all political parties have taken a raise every single year. So this April will be their fifth pay raise since the beginning of 2020. So lockdowns, pandemic, job losses, business losses, inflation, housing crisis, record number of Canadians going to food banks. Didn't matter to MPs. They just took another raise.
How about some of our other high-profile people like our governor general and such? I imagine they've got some built-in lucre coming in for the year.
Yeah, well, we haven't released numbers on the governor general's salary yet, but in previous years, yeah, pay keeps going up. Another thing too, right? Top bureaucrats, they get bonuses. Almost every single government executive is taking a bonus every year. It's like 90% of government executives taking a bonus. So, you know, we hear these politicians all the time like to say, we're all in this together. We're all in this together. But they're not talking about you and me. No, 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 no. They're talking about all 338 of them up in Ottawa. That's who's in this together. Because look, folks, all political parties, the deafening from every political party about the upcoming pay raise, or sorry, the silence from them has been deafening. Yeah. Look at me stumble over my own words here, folks. But look, here's the thing, right? MPs could stop the pay raise tomorrow. They did so with like relatively simple legislation back in 2010 to 2013. All that's lacking now is just the political will to actually stop taking more money.
Well, it's it. It gets me with some of those high positions. I know we should pay them fairly well. I mean, we want to draw people from professions that are, you know, they can bring that skill and apply it to an elected position. But boy, some of the ones, especially in the high profile, like the Prime Minister or the Governor General, because they live lives that are practically expense free. They're housed, their travel is covered. They can expense virtually everything from meals to you name it. So, I mean, their compensation is practically going straight into the bank, you know, on top of everything else. It's such a slap in the face when they're always telling the rest of us why we got to tighten our belts.
Well, Corey, you know, let me break down why this MP pay raise is so bad, even just beyond the symbolism, which is important. You need leadership, but even beyond that. So number one, you're talking about attracting better people into government. Well, we've been giving them raises every single year for how many years now? Doesn't feel like government's getting any better. But look, at the heart of it, I might say something controversial here, but at the heart of it, I don't think we need better government. I don't think we need more elitists trying to control Canadians' lives. We need less government. We need less government. That's what we need. Cut taxes. Stop spending so much. Stop doing so much that you're doing that's creating all these hardships. But number two, all these pay raises, you know what's happened? Our members of parliament, the people in the House of Commons, who are supposed to represent us common people, they've become financially divorced from the reality that we live in. So no wonder they're raising all these taxes, printing all these money, having these huge deficits that drive inflation. They don't feel it like we do. But number three, if you want to balance the budget, you got to take air out of the ballooning bureaucracy in Ottawa. Okay. And before the major union went on strike last year in Ottawa, they were pointing to member of parliament pay raises as a reason why the bureaucrats should also take more money from taxpayers. So look, these MPs, they need to cut their own pay so they have the moral authority to force the departments to actually find some savings as well.
Well, yeah, and you mean you brought up even New Zealand. I mean, you're talking about somebody who's certainly not a conservative, who at least led by example in that front. I'm going way farther back for some of the folks, I guess, but that was one of the first things that Ralph Klein did before he cut, and he cut the civil service, but he cut MLA pay first. And they were still well compensated, but at least it showed, hey, we're taking our hit before we put it on to others. And if this federal government is showing no interest in trimming their own compensation, then yeah, it doesn't look like they have any interest whatsoever in trimming the expenses of the bureaucracy.
And they don't. You know, like the Trudeau government has added, what, like 98,000 bureaucrats since it came to power, a 40% increase. I think the total increase in payroll for the federal government has gone up by more than 60% since 2016. bonuses, pay raises, tens of thousands of additional bureaucrats, and we wonder why our tax bill keeps going through the roof. And it's not even just taxes that are going up. The debt is ballooning. The Trudeau government has essentially doubled the entire federal debt since being in office. Okay, and what does that mean? Well, let's look at interest charges. This year, interest charges on the debt will be $52 billion. That's the same amount of money that the federal government sends to the provinces in health transfers. In 2028, interest charges on the debt will be more than what the government collects through its GST. So every time you go to the store, you buy that product, you pay that GST, every penny they take from you will be from the GST will be going just to pay interest charges on the government credit card.
But the taxes are good for us, right? I mean, Prime Minister Trudeau just the other day said if he could just sit down with every Canadian for 5 minutes, he'd make us understand why the carbon tax is actually good for us. Maybe you can explain it, because I'm not sure how he could convince me in 5 minutes to do that.
Yeah, as if like it's almost insulting to our intelligence. It's not almost, it is, right? Yeah. It's almost like they think like, oh, the rubes just don't understand our infinite wisdom and how good they've got it. It's like, no. We do understand that the carbon tax makes it more expensive for us to fuel our cars to get to work. We do understand that the carbon tax makes it more expensive for us to heat our homes during winter. We do understand that the carbon tax makes every trip to the grocery store more expensive. It's the politicians with these inflated salaries, the inflated pensions, the inflated perks who don't understand what they're doing to the people. And, you know, the carbon tax, guess what, folks? Going up April 1 again, it'll cost 17 cents a liter of gas, about 21 cents per liter of diesel, and about 15 cents per cubic meter of natural gas. And for the average Alberta family, well, the carbon tax will cost the average Alberta family about $900 more in a year than what they get back in rebates.
And that's money we just can't afford to keep pumping out. Well, all we can do is keep shouting. I mean, I know that Trudeau's not going to convince us the carbon tax is good, but maybe you can convince enough elected officials that it's bad. I appreciate you guys at the Federation holding their feet to the fire. Where can people find more information on what you're up to, Franco?
Hey, if you guys like what we're doing, head over to taxpayer.com, sign a couple petitions. You can follow us on essentially all big social media platforms. Just type in Canadian Taxpayers Federation. If you want to follow me, just type in @Franco_nomics. And Corey, thank you so much for having me on today. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, you too. Thanks, Franco. Oh, good to see you again.
Cheers, man.
All right. So yes, just that reminder, guys, it's Canadian Taxpayers Federation. And yeah, they really do. They dig in there, you know, some of that dry stuff. I mean, it's economics, but it does impact you whether you like it or not. Let the pointy-headed geeks like Franco and the others dig in there and get that and encapsulate it for you so you can see just how badly you're taking it. And they do a great job of it. So check out their site, guys, the Taxpayers Federation, lots of resources. And yeah, I mean, the media certainly doesn't seem to be holding government to account anymore. So we can count on perhaps groups like the Taxpayers Federation and Franco to do it. I'll kind of close off with one other spending thing. We saw recently. So the Liberal government has decided they're going to fund the UNRWA again. You know, that's the United Nations branch. The whole United Nations is sick. I don't think we should be giving any money to the entire organization. But of all of them, the UNRWA, I mean, even they had to admit, most developed countries, as soon as they found out that that group, and again, it doesn't matter where you are on the Israel-Palestine issue or whatever's happening over there, that group was corrupted. That group was funding, their employees were taking part with Hamas. This was problematic, to say the least. In fact, most of the world was appalled. And most of the countries in the world said, we're not giving you any more money to fund terrorist activities over there. That was supposed to be helping people on the ground. That was supposed to be helping Palestinians. Well, what did we get out of Calgary here? Out of Canada? Canada jumped on and said, yes, we're going to cut the funding. Oh, but we already just cut the last check. So, we won't cut that one. And then basically yesterday they said, yeah, we're going to keep giving the money again. They never really stopped. They never really stopped. When we're tight on money in general, and this is when the government starts, again, no matter what side of that conflict you're on, is this where our money's supposed to be going? Or if you really want it to be humanitarian, there's better humanitarian groups than that corrupted pile of crap Hamas funding group, the UN RWA. I mean, they were tied to Hamas. It sounds like they were teachers, of course, which were teaching children about the evils of Jews and the usual crap. That was through that same UN RWA group. This government is taking our money and throwing it all over the place on interests that are not serving us whatsoever. That's just the latest. It's just the latest. We've got to get it under control. I started the show off by kind of going on about, you know, again, our GDP per capita ratio, which really indicates how badly down the economic toilet we're going right now. And then we see this government that's out of control, just throwing our money away left and right. As Franco said, they're borrowing us over $1 trillion. We're talking billions of dollars. I hate that in my household budget when you see money going away to interest payments, right? That's borrowed money. That's just money flushed away. Well, we're getting that money flushed away now. More than we're bringing in GST is going out in interest. There's the irony of the left. Oh, we hate big corporate entities. We can't stand those corporate folks. Well, what do you think? It's a mom and pop lender on the corner that's lending the federal government the money to do all this crap? No, this is the big financial institutions, and your money is going to them in interest rather than healthcare or any of the things you feel government should be spending money on. We got some serious problems, folks. But hey, you guys who've been tuning in, you're keeping up with it. You know what's going on. I like try to keep you up to date on it. I have run out of time to twist your ear for today. I'm sure we'll make things positive somehow in the long run. We just got to keep at it and keep on them. So thank you very much for tuning in today, guys. Tune in tonight. The pipeline will be on. I'll be hosting that with a panel of a couple other folks. And we will see you all again here next week at this time to dive into a whole pile more issues. Thanks again.
Canadian Shooting Sports Association. Without the CSSA, our gun rights would have been taken long ago. These guys are on the front lines helping to draft smart and intelligent firearms regulations and legislation in Canada, and more importantly, educating the public about how we keep guns out of the hands of the wrong people. To become a member, it's absolutely worth every penny.